This is our last week for the year before we head off for the holidays. We're replaying some of our most popular conversations from 2015. And I have to say that the one we recorded with Magda Zabanski was perhaps the most popular of the whole year. Magda Zabanski is one of Australia's most loved comic performers. She's been on our screens for several decades. But aside from her weight loss women's mag thing, she's kept her personal life private, and fair enough. Magda has written a compelling memoir called Reckoning. She wrote it over many years and only showed it to a publisher when it was finished. It shows her evolution from migrant to Sharpie chick to women's shelter volunteer to comedian. The central thread of her book is her relationship with her Scottish mum and her Polish dad, whom she loved dearly. And for a long while, the thought of finding out the truth of what her dad did as a young man in the war terrified her. I spoke to Magda Zabanski at a live event organised by the Wheeler Centre at Melbourne's Athenaeum Theatre. Before we get started, I'd just like you to read the opening line from your book, please.
Sure. If you had met my father, you would never, not for an instant, have thought he was an assassin.
That's got to be one of the more impressive opening lines for a memoir I've ever read. When did your father first tell you that he was an assassin?
Look, I would have probably been in my late teens. I never took it very seriously, but it did register.
Did you believe him?
Yeah, I did, but I didn't quite get the seriousness of it, and I hadn't really put Poland in its place properly in order to understand where Poland was in relation to the Second World War. And I'd always thought, because all the films I'd seen were about Americans and British soldiers, I thought the Polish War was kind of peripheral. And then gradually over time I started to realise exactly how much Poland was at the heart of the horror and how close my father was to all of that.
How was it that your Polish father got to meet your Scottish mother after the war?
Well, after the Warsaw Uprising in 44, my father, along with many other combatants, escaped through a sewer. And he did tell me several times about what that experience was like, which was pretty harrowing. He was in three POW camps altogether, and then he was liberated by the Russians. He knew that would be bad news and that he'd probably be executed. But a couple of American fighter pilots got him over to the American lines. He made his way to Scotland, where he met my mother, and then he was being trained to be parachuted back into Poland and keep fighting when the war ended.
And they met, what, at a dance or
something? They met in Dunfermline Glen. they were just hanging around. My mother had two other sisters, so there were the three McCarthy girls, who, as I said, they started out with a very plain name, McCarthy, and ended up with the curlicued names Sosnowski, Szubański and Modjor. all on account of the fact that they were hanging out at Dunfermline Glen, and the Polish officers were Catholic, and my family, unusually, was a Scottish Catholic family. And my grandmother took pity on these poor young men, and they were invited back to, you know, play the piano in the parlour and that sort of thing. Of a very working-class family, I have to stress.
You settled for a while in Liverpool, in England, and that's where you were born. Yep. What pictures do you have in your head of Liverpool as a little girl?
I really remember Christmas very vividly. It was a white Christmas. We used to go down to Formby Beach, because they're actually quite stunningly beautiful beaches in Britain. They're just cold. And it had quicksand as well, which is a little off-putting, sure. But Formby Beach is quite spectacular. There's this huge forest full of natterjack toads, and you go through all these sand dunes, and then there's a fringe of pine trees, and you see the Irish Sea and the beach through these pine trees. And we used to go every year to collect our Christmas tree. But chiefly my memories are of my grandmother, my mum's mother, Meg.
And how was she with you?
Oh, she was adorable. She was my conspirator. You know, she was like parental love with the thorn of anxiety removed. And people are relating to that. she was always baking, and she was very warm and had a thick Scottish accent. My mother has a Scottish accent as well. But I remember I wet my pants one time and I was terrified of telling my mother, and my grandmother said, "Och, not to worry, hen, this will be our wee secret."
Well, not anymore, it isn't.
No. My mother did say to me the other day, she said, "Oh, for God's sake, what are you going to blab about now?"
there were two kids, your oldest sister Barbara and then Chris, your older brother, and then 8-year interval before you came along.
Yeah.
Did that mean, though, that you were pretty much on your own? No. No.
I did ask my mother that and she said, no, you were a joy.
But she would say that, wouldn't she?
She would. Yeah, I was very isolated. I very much lived in my imagination. I was also lonely. I used to crave having a sibling about the same age as me. But it meant that I really did retreat into my imagination quite a lot.
What kind of little rituals did you develop?
Well, I was a funny kid. I was, and I'm still the same. I'm really sort of bold and gregarious in some ways and then riddled with anxiety in other ways. And I still do it. I have this funny habit of, as someone is speaking, I will count out on my fingers how many syllables until it gets to a multiple of 4. So I'm at 3 there, so I need to say something else so I can get to 4 or I can't stop. Things like that. I know. I don't know why. Well, I do. It's an anxiety-relieving technique, but I did all sorts of little quirky things like that.
I now really feel really self-conscious about what I'm saying to you.
I know.
Now.
I'm sitting here counting how many syllables in every sentence.
You'd be looking at me going, one more syllable. And you're still a bit like that today?
Yeah, I still have, you know, people sort of want you to have cured the anxiety and depression, and it's not sort of really the way it works. You manage it. And I'm not someone who's plagued with it terribly in the way that some people are, but I've certainly flirted with it. I still have my odd, quirky, slightly OCD little habits for sure.
I do this myself. I name all the US presidents in my head as a way of, I don't know, a little hidey hole or something in my mind.
That's a very nerdy hidey hole.
I know.
Who's in there with you? Oh, no one.
People like George W. Bush, and it's not good. What brought the family to Australia?
Look, the reason that we were always given was the weather. My father hated the cold in Britain. It's a very dank cold. And although Poland gets cold, it's a dry cold. But really, he had this opportunity. He worked as a textile technologist, which is kind of like a textile chemist, for a subsidiary of ICI. So we were flown out. So we weren't typical migrants. We didn't come on a boat. We had a house.
So it was nylon that brought you out?
It was nylon, yeah. Knickers and pantyhose. In fact, he specialised in flammability. And you'll be surprised to know that nylon isn't one of the worst, but that's a whole other thing.
Why was getting off the plane at Essendon Airport such a hellish experience for you, Mags?
Well, we arrived on the 23rd of December 1965. The door of the plane opened at Essendon Airport and it was 105 degrees in the shade. And the tarmac was melting, and then we had to drive. It would have been over 40, maybe 50 kilometres from there to Bayswater.
Well, you couldn't even touch the car door handle.
Couldn't touch the car door handle. We had a very rude introduction to... It was really like we'd just been plunged into hell, to be perfectly honest.
So, like, everything's baking hot. You can't touch the door handles of the car. You can't walk on the ground. Yeah. It's just what it's like all the time in Melbourne.
Yeah, that was the picture that we formed.
The first night you had in your house in Bayswater, you write you were... The family was troubled by a strange sound in
the
night.
Yes, there was this strange, eerie, high-pitched sound. And my brother and father went to look at the fuse box and everyone was like going, what's going on? It sounded sort of electrical and threatening in nature. And I was sent next door and this flat, faded little girl sort of opened the flywire door and I said, you know, what's this noise? And she just went, cicadas. We were effing clueless.
How did your dad take to the heat?
Only mad dogs and my father would go out in the midday Australian sun. And he wouldn't just go out in the sun, he would mow the lawn in it with his Bombay bloomers whistling Polish war songs. It was quite a sight to behold. That was his way of assimilating, if you will.
At some point your dad decided that you were going to be the smart one in the family. But was he a bit competitive with you about that?
Yeah. I mean, my brother and my sister are all really smart, but we relocated here at an awkward age for them. But I got very good marks in primary school. And then my father decided that I was going to go to university, and I may have decided that myself, I don't know. And he was strangely competitive, I think because he lost his childhood. Poland was invaded when my father was 15, and everything changed. You know, before that he had this extraordinary, very middle-class life with his family, going to the ballet and the circus, playing lots of soccer. And then when the Nazis invaded, you couldn't even play soccer, it was illegal. And he was very academically oriented, as was his sister, my aunt Danuta. And they used to have a sort of academic athletics. And he never beat her. And then he left the country, and it was like he was a contender who never got to fight the big prize fight. So instead he would beat us, you know, at whatever it was we were doing.
What, eight-year-old kids?
Eight-year-old kids. Yeah, I don't think he's the only dad who does that, but or did that. I can hear people going, yeah.
I don't think parents are always entirely aware of what that thing does to kids when you say, you're going to be the smart one. Yeah. Did that make you a bit anxious about
love? Yeah, it made me very academically anxious, and I would sort of fret about... I can remember, you know, those anxiety habits that I have at a very early age. If my marks weren't good enough, I'd have sleepless nights. If I hadn't done my homework, I'd have sleepless nights. And it's a very migrant thing too, second-generation migrant thing, classic sort of expectation that, you know, you've come to the new country and you will succeed. There was very much that sort of pressure as well.
Today you're hearing a conversation with Magda Zabanski, who has just written a memoir called Reckoning. Was recorded in front of a live audience at Melbourne's Athenaeum Theatre.
Your dad had a secret book you became aware of in their house, a book that was wrapped in brown paper.
Yeah.
And you were told, rather foolishly, don't ever look in that book.
Was
it a stack of Polish Playboy magazines or what?
No, it was called Dni Powstania, which means Days of Uprising. And needless to say, I couldn't resist it. And I peeled back the pages of that book, and it was all photographs that were taken during the Warsaw Uprising. And of the 300 pages of that book, I don't think there's one single building that's not at least partly torn down. And it was in that book that I saw my first dead body. And I was pretty young. I was maybe only six or seven, and I couldn't understand it. It was a rotting corpse. And
Could you tell... That's what it was at first?
At first, no. It sort of looked like a head with a hole in it and a hand, and it looked like the Wicked Witch after she'd melted. You know, I couldn't really quite get what it was. And it became sort of like a solemn ritual to go back, and for some reason I was absolutely fascinated and drawn to that terrible picture, and I wanted to understand what it was. Eventually I asked my father, and he was very dismissive and said, "It's a dead body. You know, what are you doing looking at that book? You shouldn't be looking at that book." And the message from him was, you know, that's just part of what goes on. You're silly. You shouldn't have looked at it. But to him, it was nothing, you know.
It sounds completely nightmarish. How did you manage the memory of what you saw in that book?
Well, as I described my father, in some ways growing up with him was like a masterclass in dissociation, and there were allowable feelings, courage, bravery, you know, compassion was allowed too, but weakness and fear, any sort of squeamishness just weren't condoned. And so you just learnt to sort of cut off from any of those kind of feelings and detach from them really. And it took me, you know, quite a while to learn how to feel those feelings properly and how to reintegrate them.
You're being taught to do that at the age of six.
Yeah, yeah. And it went on. There were other experiences too, like seeing a documentary about the Holocaust and watching it with my father. I must have been about eight or nine. And my father recognising one of the streets and saying that was where his family had had their house, because they'd been in that part of Warsaw that was rezoned as the ghetto. And I realised with horror that this wasn't something I could easily dissociate from, that my father had really been right in the middle of the heart of darkness in a way. And as I was watching bodies being bulldozed into pits, I was like eight or nine, you know, and I think a lot of us of my generation were exposed to those kind of images fairly young. And I looked to my father for reassurance because I was beside myself. And I saw this flicker of contempt on his face.
For whom? For what?
For me, for my emotionality. It was very small, it was slight, but it was there. And there was always this sort of thing with my father that you had to man up in those kind of situations. Because, of course, to him, he'd had to perform a kind of emotional triage and jettison a lot of his finer feelings in order to survive that war, you know.
There's a picture in your book of you in a tennis outfit and you're what, I don't know, 10 or 11 or 12?
11, yeah.
11, on the front page of the Sun News pictorial, as it was back then, doing a backhand shot, and your tongue's poking out of your mouth, and you look, quite frankly, adorable, Mags, in that picture. Tennis was very big for you. How hard did your dad drive you when it came to tennis?
One phrase to say to you, Eastern European father tennis coach, assassin.
Your dad was Demir Dokic before his time, was he?
He was no Demir Dokic. He was... but he was... A lot of his pent-up stuff from the war, I think, bizarrely played itself out on the tennis court. We all have some arena that the drama of our life is family life. It becomes a metaphor. And it's not surprising that someone who'd done what he'd done ended up in a sport where it's all about killer instinct.
Is that what he said to you?
Yeah, he told me when I was 9 I had no killer instinct. And and I was wiped in the way that only my father could wipe you. My God, when you were wiped, you were wiped. He thought he was doing the right thing. His mission in some ways was to toughen us up and prepare us for life in the way that he understood it. Although he knew we were in Australia and it was a peaceful land comparatively, Aboriginal experience notwithstanding, but compared to the sort of, you know, what he'd just come from in Europe, it was a tranquil time that we were living in. But he, in some way, I think, was really preparing us to be tough.
What did he tell you when you started to put on a little bit of weight that time?
He told me to starve myself because his mother was an overweight woman. My father was a fat little kid. He started to lose a bit of weight, and then during the war, of course, they were under starvation rations. And then when he was in the POW camp, he lost all the weight. And he emerged from the POW camp looking very handsome. And he sort of formed this view. I think he wanted to impart to me, you know, the lesson that he'd learned of how to manage his weight and stop the family curse, as it were.
You and I grew up in a similar part of Melbourne, the outer eastern suburbs.
Yeah.
And part of afternoons was watching I Dream of Jeannie, Bewitched, Gilligan's Island, and the Brady
where this
Bunch.
Is going. Yeah.
I had a crush on Marcia Brady. When,
yeah, me
when
too.
Did you yeah, when did you realise?
I didn't know if I wanted to be her or kiss her. I was very confused. Sorry, what was your question?
When did you know?
That's when did I know? I think the moment I laid eyes on Marcia. Although it was a very confusing time for me because I also did have a bit of a crush on Keith Partridge, but then he was kind of girly. It was just so damn normal, you know, and I had this... I mean, I grew up... To pronounce my name properly, the way my father would say it, is Magda Szubański. And I, of course, grew up with everyone saying Magna Zabanski. My father, when I was 6 years old, got a very life-threatening cancer. He had a huge tumour in his leg and it was very likely that he would die. He survived it and went on for another 40 years. But there are a lot of, you know, we'd migrated here, we'd left behind all our family. There were a lot of destabilising things, a lot of things that were rocking my boat. And, you know, Marcia, she was just solid ground, mate. She was something I could rely on.
Tell me how you and your friend Kerry used to practice, get yourself in training for kissing boys that day should come.
Yeah. Well, that's how every first gay kiss happens, is practicing for boys. And she was, in fact, practicing for boys. I wasn't, as I discovered, much to my horror. But the soundtrack for our pashing sessions was, I was obsessed with David Bowie and the song Sorrow. And it was an appropriately sad soundtrack because it didn't go well.
Pashing a girl to sorrow in the
background.
Yeah,
I know.
Something tells me you're the devil's daughter is the life of that, isn't it? I mean, but seriously, though, what did you think about all that as all that was going on? That must have been incredibly confusing.
I was terrified because I knew instinctively, and I knew even younger than that, that I was attracted to girls as well as boys, but mostly girls. And I knew instinctively that it wasn't normal and I posed a social identity threat to myself. It was terrifying.
Because lezzo was a real term of abuse.
Yeah, it really was.
Lezzo.
And it's hard to remember now just how terrible it was. It was kind of like you were cursed to be called a lezzo.
Lesbians were a real object of hate. Hatred.
Yeah, and revulsion and disgust.
Did you hate lesbians too?
Yeah, I did, yeah. And that was, you know, that was... that's what's called internalised homophobia, you know, that you introject the message from society and you believe it yourself.
So you were a bright convent school girl with a beautiful poetic imagination. How on earth did you become a Sharpie chick?
Well, one of the girls at the tennis club started dating a boy who was in a Sharpie gang, and some people here will remember the Sharpies.
Sort of shaved on top.
Yeah,
it
was
back.
The Conti cardigan, yeah. Platform shoes, a very strange way of dancing.
Yeah, it's all that.
That character I used to do, Michelle Grogan. And your fist would piston up and down in front like you were trying to punch yourself in the jaw.
It was thing as well.
Yeah, it's very weird.
My wife will do that as well. There's a certain generation of Melbourne women from a certain part of Melbourne. If you play Stevie Wright at a party, they'll leap up and start Connie dancing. And you are one of those women, aren't you?
Yeah, and it percolated right up into the middle classes as well. I sort of drifted into the periphery. By that time, I really had kind of, partly triggered by my realisation about my sexuality, had plunged into a depression, the first sort of real depression I'd ever had, and it was terrifying. I just was rudderless, and my marks at school just fell through the floor. I couldn't study, I couldn't concentrate, I didn't know what was going on. No one spoke about that sort of stuff back then, and I just sort of drifted into this gang, the Croydy Boys Sharpie gang. On the periphery, I hasten to add, I was sort of like the ladies' auxiliary, you know. I wasn't a fully fledged member at all. I was the blue stocking Sharpie.
Did you ever get into a scrag?
A scrag fight? No, I nearly did on the train once. I got picked, as we used to say. I was sitting there in my prim convent girl uniform, because I was a convent schoolgirl during the week and a Sharpie on the weekends. This genuine bona fide Sharpie girl picked me, and the way I knew I was picked is she came up to me and she said, "What are you f***ing staring at?" And luckily for me, the train lurched and she was standing on 4-inch platform shoes. And have you seen those YouTube clips of supermodels on their platform shoes falling over? She did that all the way back along the aisle of the train. And it saved my life.
You mentioned there you got a bit isolated for a while and a bit depressed, and you said this is when the great hunger started.
Yeah.
What form did that take, Mags?
I just, sort of about 13 or 14, and I'm sure it was a combination of the depression but also hormonal stuff and a whole lot of things and probably a desire to hide, I think. But when I was about 13 or 14, I was overwhelmed by this voracious hunger. And it would wake me up in the middle of the night, and my brother was working at the Brockhoff biscuit factory at the time. That's a diabolical combination, a hungry teenage girl whose brother works in a biscuit factory. And I used to sneak out every night to watch movies in the middle of the night and eat chocolate biscuits. And my weight, as they charmingly say, began to balloon. It was so frightening as well. I felt like there were so many things that I was completely out of control of in my life, and that was one of them. And no one knew what to do about it. Still, people really don't understand the mechanisms of why people put on weight. It's, you know, I have seriously looked into this, believe me. The biology, the physiology, the mechanics, the emotional, all of those factors are enormously complex. And so all of that was going on for me, and I had no understanding of what was going on, and it was quite frightening.
At the end of high school, you got a role in a school production of Salad Days.
I did.
What do you remember of the feeling of going on stage after all the rehearsals and it's opening night and your parents are in the crowd and people you know are in the crowd and you've got to go on stage and perform? What do you remember of that feeling?
It was just this incredible sense of serenity and the certainty that this is where I belong, of homecoming in a sense. And all the diffuse, confused parts of me congealed into a hole, and I made sense to myself and I no longer felt like an outsider.
What did your mum and dad say after that show?
Well, first of all, I was playing a sort of 1930s dowager and I looked very like his mother, which must have been really freaky because he never saw his mother again from the age of 20. So it would have been very emotional for him as well, because once he was carted off to the POW camp, he could never return to Poland because resistance fighters were not made welcome by the communists. So it was very emotional for him to see me there looking, and he went, "Ay, ay, ay, she looks just like my mother." And then the other thing he said, because my father really didn't praise us a lot, but he said, She's got it. And you knew when my father said something like that, that he meant it. And then my mother, who, my mother is actually the funny one in the family, she said, "Oh, Hen, you were very funny." And that coming from her really meant something. So the two of them, they both, they knew that something had kind of happened in that moment.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
Magda Zabanski, one of Australia's best-loved comic performers, is my guest today. I recorded this conversation with Magda at Melbourne's Athenaeum Theatre at an event organised by the Wheeler Centre.
You got into uni in an arts degree, and you write you spent your first term of uni sitting in the student union eating Smarties.
Yes, for want of a better idea. I just came from a sort of no account, like Siena College, where I went, convent school, academically had a great record, but socially, you know, I didn't know anyone. And I was incredibly lonely.
You joined the campus feminist club. Was that because for the politics or the vague hope you might meet other lesbians?
Both. Primarily the latter. It's funny that the feminist club was a club along with the Monty Python Society and, you know, bushwalking. But there you have it. feminism as a nice hobby, ladies. You could take that up later. And gents.
But there would have been a lot of lesbians in that group who were pretty uncomplicated and untortured about their homosexuality.
There was some... most people of an older generation, very few escaped unscathed from societal homophobia. Most of us really took a bit of a battering and struggled. You know, people my age and older really had a hard time of it. But there were some people there who, there were some people who were sort of role models who were comfortable in their skin, and that was incredible to be around. And then I found a bunch of friends who were going through the same journey as me, somewhat tortured, some less, some more than others. But it was just incredible to finally feel that I wasn't the only one.
You met and fell in love with a girl called Jane.
Yeah.
How happy were you once you were able to actually do that?
I was so happy. It's possibly the happiest I've ever been. You know, I was 20 years old. I was working in a women's refuge and I had a girlfriend. I'd ticked every box. I was kicking goals. And there's a certain innocence to your happiness at that age because you just think everything's just going to keep on getting better. and so it's an unalloyed happiness. As you get older, it's an alloyed happiness that's tinged with experience, and you know things can go wrong, and you know. But when you're young, it's just absolutely pure, innocent happiness. So it was an amazing feeling.
You were out to some of those friends, but were you out to your family at that point?
No, I wasn't out. I'd come out to my sister when I was about 17. My beautiful sister Barbara, who's here, yay! And she was gorgeous. You know, that made a huge difference to me. But I still hadn't come out to my parents yet.
Going off to Europe for the first time, well, since you migrated to Australia, you stay for a while in Scotland with your mum's cousin, Molly.
Auntie Molly. Auntie Molly.
How did she welcome you into the family?
Molly is really, she had this wizened face, you know, and I walked up, she lived above the Spud You Like in Toll Cross, seven flights up. She was in her late 60s, and I trudged with my backpack up these seven flights. They nearly burst my heart. I got to the top, knocked on the door, opened the door, went inside, and Molly just turned around and gave me this vivisecting glance and said, "For God's sake, what a weight you've got on you. Where did you get that? Your mother was always bone thin." And then she turned back to the television, sucked on her silk-cut cigarette, and that was the greeting. She was the most hospitable woman, though. She was, despite that, that's the Scots for you. I was raised, my mum's Scottish, they'll, you know.
It's a Scottish welcome.
Yeah.
Funnily enough, isn't it?
Yeah.
Going from there to Poland seemed to really undo you a bit, actually. Going to Poland.
It actually did.
This is early 1980s, isn't it?
82. Yeah, well, I was sort of, you know, had styled myself as a, you know, a campus lefty. And, you know, all the identity, you know, issues that I'd had until that point kind of began to become explained by left-wing politics, and I felt reassured by that and contained somewhat. And then when I went to Poland, that was a communist country, it all began to unravel. But it was also the grief of being in the homeland that my father had left when he was 20. He'd seen his sister once since then. He never saw his parents again. I never met my grandparents. They'd gone. And there was just this... It was the most heartbreakingly sad place, Poland, in 1982. There were bullet holes everywhere. There was just... You know, Warsaw, as I describe it in the book, the Polish name for it, Warszawa, is a lovely name. But in English, it's Warsaw. Warsaw. And that's what it feels like, the nation's war wound. And I went to Poland, and the first place my cousin Magda Zawadzka took me to was Pawiak. I thought maybe we were going to a cafe or something. And it's this huge prison where they used to take people before taking them to concentration camps. And as we sat there, the guy read out over the speaker messages that people had left. They'd leave written on little tram tickets or cigarette papers. They'd scrawl their last message before dying and then shove it into a hole in the wall. And they'd retrieved all of these and they would read them out. And that was the first place that my cousin took me. And she said, "I'm sorry for this, but this is our history. This is your father's history." So I was plunged headfirst into that history, into that loss, into that gaping wound and hole that existed where my family should have been, plus the sort of ideological ropes that had tethered me were just ripped away from me, because communist Poland in 1982 was a brutal place. It was under martial law.
It's just after the Solidarity crackdown,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And so I felt like I had nothing to tether me. I was also breaking up with my girlfriend, you know. It was just everything was sort of going wrong, and it sort of plunged me into another depression, to be honest.
But back in Australia, you joined Melbourne University Review and you did a production called Too Cool for Sandals, and I know
yes.
this because this is when we first met.
It is when we first met, when we were touring in Adelaide mm-hmm. and we met the Dung Anthony All-Stars at a nightclub.
Yeah, that's
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
You very kindly, your group were selling out the place in Adelaide. We were getting four people. You gave us a little cameo and we did a bit better after that, which was kind. But you know, I do remember you very, you and Michael Veitch as part of that review, and I do remember you very vividly because afterwards you were, you probably don't realise, but there was a certain amount of cachet amongst the Tim and Debbies in the crowd about you. They're going, "Well, I quite liked Magda Szymanska, actually. I thought she was excellent on stage. She was really funny." People going, "Magda, yeah, Magda, yeah, I thought Magda was quite good. Yeah, I thought she was good." There was a kind of cool vibe around you. Were you aware
really?
Of that at the time?
I've never been cool in my life. I wished I'd known. Oh, I could have got a root. Oh. Always missing the boat, you know?
Honestly, if you couldn't have hooked up with another lesbian in that venue at that time, you mustn't have been trying hard at all. But I do remember that. And from that, you got invited to be part of The D-Generation and a whole lot of other shows coming from that and Fast Forward as well. And you created characters like Lynn Postlethwaite. I always thought there was a real camp sensibility with someone like Lynn.
Well, I didn't actually create her. She was originally created by John Alsop and Andrew Knight. And I performed her, and I certainly took a very particular angle in terms of the style of performance and the look of her. I'd seen a woman on the tram who looked like her, believe it or not. It looked like she'd done her makeup in 1940 and then just reapplied it constantly since. And I went to Jürgen Zielinski, who is the makeup artist at the ABC, and described to him, and we had it down pat. Right down to the her rouge, instead of rouge ladies, you'll get this one was just lipstick that was like smeared. And that was the beginning of something that was a real feature of my development of characters, actually, is working with makeup artists, Jürgen Zielinski and then Barb Cousins, because I very much work from the outside in. Because I am sort of a shy show-off, the shy part of me only really feels liberated. Although that's changing now because I'm middle-aged and I'm more comfortable with myself. But when I was younger, that mask of having a character to hide behind very much allowed me to be more playful. And that was how a lot of my most well-known characters developed.
Tell me how Gina Riley, once you started working with her, forced the issue a bit with you one night.
Gina, who I hated on sight. Gina, I think it's hilarious. I hated her on sight and she hated me. I thought she was a crass show-off and she thought I was a stuck-up snob, and we were both right. We also both pride ourselves on being very bad judges of character. I'm a terrible judge of character. I know you're not supposed to say that, but I am. But Gina was one of the first people outside of my little uni group who she just flat out asked me if I was a lesbian. And I was sort of flabbergasted and then relieved, really. But Gina just had that disarming way about her because the reason it was okay was because it was so patently clear that she didn't care. And I just felt very comfortable around her because of that.
There was this is probably my favourite sketch from Fast Forward, and I think you were a part of it. I can't quite remember, but I think the premise of the sketch was that Melbourne was going to have a straight Mardi Gras.
Yes.
And there are a bunch of gay people standing around watching the straight people going, yay, on a float. Going down Swanston Street, and gay people are watching them, and they're going, well, I suppose it's all right so long as they don't shove it down our throats. Was that you?
Yeah, that was us. Yeah, yeah.
And where did you get that line from?
I can't remember if I wrote that line or not. I certainly was a part of that sketch, but my father did used to say that over the years, you know. As so many parents used to say what would be deemed sort of homophobic things now, they just said them casually. They didn't really realise or get it, you know. But he used to say, I don't care what they do as long as they don't try and shove it down my throat. Little realising. I don't think they will, Dad, you know. I don't think they will.
You got to live in an apartment in South Yarra. And there's a story there about how you were woken up at 6 a.m. one morning. Just tell me what happened that morning, Mags.
Oh, that was an extraordinary morning. I was sleeping with the window open and I just heard this bang, and it was a noise like nothing I'd ever heard before, and then there was a woman screaming like no other scream I'd ever heard before. And it turned out that what had happened was there was a racing car driver and his wife who lived diagonally opposite, and someone had put a bomb at the foot of their bed. And this bomb had gone off, and it was, you know, right opposite where I was living. And I just immediately rang the fire brigade and then ran out, because all I was thinking is, you know, cups of tea, blankets, buckets of water, just any, you know, there's other people in other flats that might need some sort of help. They might want to come back to my flat for a cup of tea or, you know, just do something. And no one else ran out. There was about five of us. It was in South Yarra. And it was eerily quiet. And then, you know, it's hard to discuss this actually, to be honest, but there was this wall of flame and the man came out. He'd had his feet blown off. And he came through the flame with his hands to his head, completely on fire. And he stood there for about 2 minutes talking to us. And we were just yelling at him, just throw yourself over the balcony. And he was too far gone, and he just asked after his wife and wanted to know that she was all right. And then after some time, he slumped and fell behind the balcony and died. And it was just all silent. You know, I'd never seen someone die before, except in a movie, but of course there was no soundtrack. And it was the worst thing I've ever seen, bar none. And then later that day, you know, I had to go to work to film Degeneration, filming comedy sketches, and it was the most bizarre juxtaposition. And really, I don't think anyone quite understood, and I don't think I quite understood what I'd seen and how I was traumatised. I knew I felt very weird and upset about it.
And what happened when you rang your dad and told him about what you'd seen?
Well, there was no one I could really tell who'd seen anything like that. I felt suddenly like I wasn't in quiet, safe Melbourne anymore, and I didn't know who to talk to who'd seen anything like that except my father. And I rang my father and he said, oh, I'm so sorry to hear that. And he said, well, you just have to put it behind you. During the war, I saw the Jews throw their children into the flames and jump in after them. You just have to put it behind you. And that was his lesson in how you dealt with those kinds of situations. But it also, yet again, it was that feeling of even when I experienced something, and this is classic second generation kind of stuff, that nothing you experience feels like it, I don't want to say rates because it's not a scale or a hierarchy, but compared to what your parent has been through, everything you're going through, even something like that feels diminished somehow. And so you're left with this strange sense of not knowing what you have the right to feel.
The insignificance of your own feelings.
The insignificance of your own feelings and this strange sort of shadow sense of realising that it's a small example of what your parent went through and figuring out how you fit in relation to that. It was a really quite disturbing event, and I never found out, that the courts never found out who did it or why. I saw occasionally interviews with the woman who'd survived. Luckily, I can't remember her name, I'm afraid, but she looked like she actually went on to have a happy life, which I was very pleased to see. But it was, it was a horrible event. Yeah.
So in 1997, you bought a camcorder, and you went around to your parents' house, and you sat your father down, and you interviewed him about what actually happened to him and what he did during the war. Tell me how that unfolded, Max.
Well, I'd heard the stories for years, you know, snippets, little fragments that I'd sort of pieced together. And I knew that my father was on the right side. I knew he'd been fighting the Nazis, and I knew that my family had hidden Jewish people because my whole family were involved in hiding Jewish people, my grandparents, my aunt, my uncle, my father. And I knew that, but I couldn't make sense of, given that my father was on the good side, I couldn't understand the guilt and shame. It was palpable, and I felt like I was carrying that guilt and shame, as so often happens for the next generation. And I tried to make sense of it, and I started to worry if my father had in fact been a collaborator, because that was the only kind of explanation out there in the suburbs in Melbourne, 10,000 miles away from where it had all happened, with just snippets to go on. I put two and two together and came up with five, and I was terrified that perhaps my father had in some way collaborated. And much as it was absolutely terrifying for me to sit down with that camera and film him, I had to know what he had done. And so I asked him permission, and I told him that at some point I might want to tell his story. And before we began filming, he said, "I will speak of this once and then never again." And then he spoke for the next 6 hours about his life in Poland during the war.
What did he remember of when the war came? Because World War II starts pretty much when Hitler invades Poland. What does he remember of that invasion?
The first thing was that the first Germans that entered Warsaw, one of them slapped his face. There were two guys in. They were travelling on a motorbike, and they asked directions from my father, and my father said, "Ich weiß nicht," and the German slapped his face. And then the bombing started, and the planes, and a bomb landed near. My father and my grandfather were out just in the hall, in the front door of the apartment block, and a limb was flung through the air and landed near my father. The way he would talk about the war was a strange combination of there would be the guilt and the shame thing, and then he would change gear, and it would be like a boy's own adventure. And I'm sure there are many people here whose fathers or grandparents fought in the war and felt that same sort of schizophrenic dissonance. So for him, you know, part of it was initially an excitement. He said they used to go up onto the top of the block of apartments and watch the dogfights between the Polish and the German planes.
How was he brought into the resistance?
Well, he started when he was 15 or 16.
15 or 16.
Yeah.
He joins the Polish Execution Squad, Unit 993/W, Revenge Company.
Yeah, Kompania Zemsta.
He was
recruited at the age of 19 by his brother-in-law, my uncle, Andrzej Zawadzki, to be a part of this counterintelligence unit that was there to protect the HQ of the Polish underground. It was a top secret. No one knew of its existence. There were rumours of it. People knew of their actions and saw the results of it, but no one knew who they were. And their job basically was to execute Polish traitors who were telling the Gestapo secrets of the resistance, but these Polish traitors were also telling the Gestapo where Jewish people were hiding.
Was he a sniper?
No, it wasn't at long range. The traitor would be tried in absentia by an underground court, and then my father's unit would conduct surveillance on them, and then when the moment was right, they would run in, read them the charges of which they'd been found guilty, and then at point-blank range, shoot them.
Shoot them dead?
Yeah. Yeah.
This was his role as an assassin?
Yeah.
How did he talk about killing? the business of actually pulling the trigger and
doing that. Yeah, sorry,
I'm
feeling a little bit emotional at the moment. He had found a way to discuss it that was very objective. He brought no emotion to it. He had shut the door on it a long time ago. Mum told me after the war, he was 19 when he was in that unit, and he was even younger than that when he began killing. And when he was older, he realised the complexity of it. He said, you know, as he said, when I was young, it was black and white. You were either a Pole or you were scum. And as he grew older, it began to haunt him. And after the war, he used to beat his breast and say, I'm so guilty, you know, because he realised, as he told me later, that there was no knowing with these people who he killed what pressure they'd been under. And generally, that means torture, had they been tortured or, you know, were their family threatened or whatever. But essentially, he had to kind of shut the door on the past. I think in some ways there are, you know, I just think, you know, he thought he was doing the right thing. He was a young patriot. He was full of testosterone and idealism, like young men are. And as he said to me, one of the reasons he started doing what he was doing, his best friend, Vacek Goldfarb, was a Jewish boy. And my father said, I couldn't stand what was happening to the Jews. He said, when I saw what they were doing to the little kids, he said, I couldn't stand that. So, you know, he came from the right place about it. But it came to torment him to some extent later on, once he realised what he'd done, when he realised that he couldn't undo it, and when he realised how utterly grey and morally ambiguous the world really is.
And did you feel proud of him or ashamed or both, or was it just too big, Megs?
Yeah, I don't feel ashamed, but I did. That's why the book's called Reckoning, because I really, and it has taken me this long, and I've hidden to some extent within the world of comedy, not going near these things, because to be honest, it took me years of therapy to unpack all of this. It really, I think I came to that realisation that there are some things for which you never find a neat answer, and you have to learn to live with the ambiguity of it, and you have to learn to live with the discomfort of not knowing. Look, I feel very proud of my father in a lot of ways, but my heart breaks for him in other ways that he...
He's just a boy.
He was just a boy, and you look at so many people now who are, you know, doing the same sort of thing. And I think, what would I have done in that situation?
I don't know. You talk about a conversation you had with him over the phone. It went for several hours, went way into the night.
Yep.
And he said the most remarkable thing. I'm just going to quote you here. He said, all my life I have been terrified that one of my kids would grow up to be a traitor. Did that make any sense at all to you at the time?
No, it was about 2 months before he died, and we had these conversations and they would just spiral deeper and deeper, and I found them incredibly destabilising, but I wanted to be there for him. And he made this remark and it was so kind of wacky. I was like, what the fuck does that mean? And it took me quite some time to really understand that he was training us, toughening us up, not to be warriors so much, but his concern was that there was, I call it the stone of madness, because it was like he carried this tiny sliver of the insanity of war inside his head that he couldn't, after 40, 50 years of being away from, or more than that, you know, what, 60 years, still couldn't rid himself of, and that it was, if one of his kids was a traitor, there was this slight belief in him that he would have to kill us. He was terrified that we would be weak, and it was weak people who, for the sake of a bit of butter or bread, and maybe that's why he was weird about food too, but it was often, you know, because of those sort of things, people who would end up collaborating. Gave me very complex issues too when I piecing all of this together and realising, you know, my own inability to kind of govern myself about food and thinking, would I be one of those weak people? Would I be a traitor for a pound of butter? terrifying to think, but that's a classic kind of second generation question.
It's all complicated by the fact that the reason why you come to a place to Australia is so your kids never have to go through that crap, isn't
well,
it?
That was exactly yeah. it. That's why my father really didn't talk about it a lot, but there would be enough that you'd hear that it would just kind of freak you out, and I just had to know. I had to get to the bottom of it.
It always made you worry. You said that you never really might have had the unconditional love of your dad. You sort of knew you had it from your mum, but not your dad. But it did become apparent when you finally came out to your family, to your mum and dad.
Yeah. I was nearly outed by this women's magazine, surprise, surprise. In the 90s, this woman, she was a real toe cutter, this interviewer, and she was determined to get out of me, you know, the prize, which was the confession that I was gay.
Weeping over your pastor.
Yeah. She kept pushing the wine glass towards me, trying to weaken me. Little did she know I had been trained by an assassin. I didn't crack. I'd always wondered what I would do if someone just flat out asked me, you know, are you gay? And this woman, you know, she was hedging around. She said, there are rumours, you know, one of the rumours is that you're homosexual. How do you feel about that? And this extraordinary sang-froid came over me, and I was cool for possibly the only time in my life. And I said, oh, I don't care. And she said, oh, really? I said, no, really, I don't care. And then I went home and cried and was terrified because, you know, in the early 90s, which is when this was, if you were outed, it was a career ender. You know, the chances that I could have had the career that I've had I been outed, I'm not stupid about reading events, and I'm pretty certain it would not have gone well for me. And work is enormously important to me. You know, it's not an ancillary thing. It's like a core element of who I am. So for me to be in a situation where I couldn't do my work would have been crippling for me. So it was a very difficult conundrum to have, a very difficult dilemma. But then I went home because I thought, oh, shit, I'm going to be out. I'd better tell my mum and dad. So I went home. I got my brother. Barb was away at the time, and I told my brother, and he was gorgeous. You know, he said, I'll be there for you, and, you know, if they attack you, I'll defend you, and, you know, not physically attack, you know.
What, the Polish assassin?
Yeah, exactly. And they were gorgeous. They were gorgeous. And then we all sort of cried and hugged, and afterwards, you know, the great gift I had was that I realised then my parents' unconditional love, and my only regret was that I'd ever had to doubt it.
Ladies and gentlemen, please thank Magda Sabansky.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.